I'd like to welcome everyone to today's event. My name is Larry Whitson. I work with NIEHS Superfund Basic Research Program. We're sponsoring today's event, and we'll be having presentations from Dr. Mark Brousseau from the University of Arizona, from Lynn Wood and Michael Brooks from the Groundwater Research Lab in Ada, Oklahoma. Today's presentation is on DNAPL source zone behavior and mass flux measurement. I'd like to welcome everyone today to today's seminar. This is sponsored by NIEHS Superfund Basic Research Program. Today's event is on DNAPL's source zone behavior and mass flux measurement. This is the first in a series that the Superfund Basic Research Program will be doing examining DNAPL's issues. Some other events will be scheduled during September and October, and October, and will include such topics as monitoring in situ bioremediation, chemical and physical remediation methods, and biological remediation methods. We may also be trying to schedule a repeat of today's event. We did have a very quick filling up of our registration for this event, and hopefully we can convince today's speakers that to present again at a later date, perhaps in October or November. I'd like to introduce Jim Cummings to take over the introduction of today's seminar and to introduce today's speakers. Jim is from EPA and the Superfund program in Washington, D.C. Jim?
Very much, Larry. I appreciate the opportunity to be your moderator today, and they asked me to provide a few introductory remarks. The fact that we've got as large an audience as we do is, I think, an indication of how important the topic is for both the research and the practicing community. Obviously, DNAPL is one of the biggest challenges that we currently face. We estimate that 70% or so of our Superfund sites on the NPL are affected by DNAPL contamination. So this is a very timely topic, and the NIEHS folks are to be commended for putting on both this session and the series. I was actually able to attend the workshop that Mark Brousseau put on at the University of Arizona, which was very well done, and I think led in no small part to this ongoing series. So in addition to the excellent speakers, I thought I'd provide just a few remarks to place this activity in some kind of a context. The first set of presentations that Mark Brousseau will present will speak to the issue of source mass and behavior. Obviously, the issue of source reduction is, I think, the $64,000 question in cleanup today. The utility or futility of source reduction, if you will. Our understanding is evolving. It's been a major focus of my office's efforts here in the Technology Assessment Branch in OSWR for the last 3 to 5 years. We work with wood treaters, former manufactured gas plant sites, solvent sites on the DNAPL front, and then the large bulk terminals and refineries with regard to the LNAPLs. On the solvent site front, we are actually, even though the science is not perfectly well established, even as we speak, we're implementing a source reduction or removal remedy at a dry cleaner in Fargo, North Dakota. We've selected another in-situ remedy, resistive heating, for the first fund lead remedial action at the Pemco NPL site in Maywood, Los Angeles, California. And in-situ chemical oxidation has been selected to try to address the solvent contamination as deep as 140 feet in fractured rock at the Dublin, Pennsylvania NPL site. But we do so with full awareness of the current limitations on our understanding of the basic processes. And so we look forward to Mark's presentation and his continued work in this area. Because it's an area of evolving understanding, we kind of expect that we're going to have some science to start with. We'll do some field work, identify some other problems and areas of uncertainty, and then we'll do some more science, and that hopefully in the next 3 to 5 years we'll get to the bottom of this phenomena and decide whether source reduction and removal should be a prevalent phenomena or whether it should be more done on an exceptions basis. By the way, I'll put in a plug or a plea, if you will, is that we need some sites that we can adequately document and instrument both the source reduction and the effect on the dissolved place plume in the aftermath. Attributes of those kinds of sites would be, for example, those that have simple, relatively shallow non-commingled plumes that we could instrument cost-effectively and monitor to see what exactly happens to the plume in the long term. On the mass flux front, that'll be the second presentation by Lynn Wood from our ADA lab. This is an area of growing interest. There have been guest editorials in various remediation journals. There's a lot of interest and concern on the part of some state regulators for reasons I'll get into in a minute. But among the potential uses for the mass flux tool are determining whether you need to remediate in the first place, determining the effectiveness of remediation afterwards, possibly depending on the spatial discreteness of your mass flux tool, helping to determine zones where further treatment might be necessary, and eventually, and I put that in either exclamation points or question mark, a possible alternative to use mass flux as your determinant of your compliance or as a remedial action objective as an alternative to MCLs. But I think we're a number of years away for both practical and policy reasons for making that kind of a determination. And then also, finally, it could be used to support monitored natural attenuation determinations. And the integrated pump test developed by Georg Teutsch in Europe, our understanding has been used at dozens of applications in Europe, mostly for that kind of a determination. But there are some uncertainties with this tool, and Lynn will do several of those today, not the least of which, of course, is the dynamic nature of the subsurface, even if you don't have anthropogenic intervention, the need to allow the system to equilibrate following the installation, and also the possibility that, for example, in a treatment context, that the plume geometry may be affected by active treatment. Another area that I'd like to mention just briefly today actually links the two in the following way, and that is that many potentially responsible parties are concerned or argue that why should we do source reduction if protracted pump and treat is going to still be needed. Thus, the other half, if you will, of the $64,000 question is how long a containment remedy like pump and treat might be needed following partial source reduction. And as I've come to try to understand mass flux and mass flux measurement, I've come to the realization that that tool per se does not offer all of the insights we need into source strength or its longevity, and so some additional work is needed if we're trying to answer that particular question, the point being to justify on a cost-benefit analysis more active source intervention against the prospect that the need for a protracted pump and treat could be reduced, say, from 100 years down to 30 years or 10 years. Another area where this mass flux work and the things that Mark will talk about could be useful is in the area of combining remedies and treatment trains to perhaps get us to the point where we can discontinue our active interventions and allow monitored natural attenuation to take over. And then the final area that is obviously of interest to the practicing community is when we can expect commercial availability of the mass flux tools. And that's something that we're still waiting to hear about. As we progress through the sessions, as Larry indicated, we will have time for questions at the end of each session, and we look forward to those questions as we progress. So why don't we get on with the first of our presentations by Dr. Mark Bousseau, who's a professor in the Department of Soil, Water, and Environmental Science and Hydrology and Water Resources at the University of Arizona. Dr. Bousseau has been at the U of A since 1989. His research is focused on developing a fundamental understanding of the factors and processes of influencing transport and fate of contaminants in the subsurface, and has also been interested in the development and evaluation of innovative subsurface remediation and characterization technologies. Mark, you're up.
Okay, thank you very much, Jim. Well, hello, everyone. I'm very pleased for this opportunity to speak with all of you, and without further ado, we'll get going. So moving on to slide two, a very short advertisement for our Superfund Center or program here funded under NIHS SBRP and our focus on arsenic and chlorinated hydrocarbons and mine tailings. So just to make our director happy. So moving on to slide three, I'm sure everyone here is fully aware of the significance of having a miscible liquid present at sites and with respect to mass of contaminant providing the source of the problem and issues related to difficulty of characterizing sites that are contaminated with immiscible liquids and, of course, remediation. So moving on to slide four, as Jim noted, to paraphrase a famous former writer, the crux of the source zone issue is, should we or should we not remediate fully the source zone? And so to address that issue, we need to understand a lot of various factors and processes that go on in the subsurface. There have been several excellent recent studies, which I've listed on slide 5, that have analyzed the so-called source reduction, mass reduction, partial mass removal, however you'd like to phrase it. They've done an excellent job of characterizing and analyzing these issues. The first one was released by ITRC in 2002. The second one was from EPA in 2003. And most recently, in 2004, there was a report released by the National Research Council. So I've tried to summarize the main points on slide.
Dr. Brousseau? Okay, folks, I think we may be having an issue here with the audio. Hang on, let me see if we can figure out what is going on. Jim? Mark? Lynn?
I'm on.
I'm not sure what we've done here. We might have lost Dr. Brousseau.
Sorry, Lynn, are you on?
Yes.
Okay, if we lose him, we can just flip-flop the order and help.
Okay, let's give him just a minute here to call back in and see if that's what happened. I'm not sure. Folks, we're hanging on here just a moment. I think we've lost Dr. Brousseau. I'm trying to contact him right now to see if we can bring him back in.
While we're waiting for Dr. Brousseau, I might also mention, in addition to my previous plea, that if anybody's got any great sites where source reduction has taken place and the plume might be susceptible of monitoring, I'd love to hear about that. And also, there have been some discussions with the AEHS folks about one of the possible future sessions being about combined remedies and treatment trains. So we're obviously interested in getting some case study information on those sorts of applications as well, whether it be thermal plus bio, or thermal plus chemical, or chemical plus bio.
Hello?
Mark,
this
back.
Is Mark Brousseau. I don't know what happened. I just got disconnected somehow.
Okay, Mark, why don't you pick up where you left off? I guess you were on slide 5 or 6, going on to 6.
Thanks, Mark. I was just trying to call you. I'm glad you called back in. I had slide 5, yes.
Okay. So sorry about that. I don't know what happened. So, as I was saying, there's the three reports that came out in the last few years talking about the source zone issue, and summarizing the major points from those reports are on slide 6. And as we know, complete mass removal is not possible for most sites with Dean Apple present. So given that case, the question then becomes, is partial mass removal or so-called mass reduction beneficial? So to answer that question, we need to define the cleanup objectives for that particular site. And once those objectives have been defined, then a cost-benefit analysis would be conducted. So to carry out that cost-benefit analysis, we need to address key questions which are listed on slide 7. So the first key question is, what is the expected degree of mass reduction for whichever particular remedial action is proposed? Second, what would be the impact of that degree of mass reduction on the mass flux? And third, would this reduction in mass flux have a significant impact on the degree of risk posed by the site? To answer those questions, on slide 8, we posit that we need to understand the impact of source zone architecture and dynamics on mass flux behavior. So that becomes the key question to all of this, is what happens in the source zone? How does the distribution of the immiscible liquid and the porous medium heterogeneity, flow behavior, and the dynamics of mass transfer processes, how does that affect mass removal and correlate to the mass flux reduction, the hopefully mass flux reduction? So this leads then to slide 9. A recent study in 2001 was released by the CERTIP ESTCP program, where they put together a so-called expert panel workshop on the research needs for chlorinated solvent sites. They came up with 3 needs here. 1, to focus research on source zone issues as opposed to the plume. 2, to investigate the influence of source zone architecture and mass transfer processes. And 3, to look at pore scale processes. More recently, as Jim mentioned, we held a workshop here in Tucson to look at research needs for the DNAPL area, and I've listed some of them here. 1, again, to look at source zone mass flux processes and to key in on this relationship between mass reduction and mass flux, which I'll come back to in a moment. 2, the distribution and mass transfer behavior of immiscible liquids at all scales of interest, from the pore to the column and intermediate all the way to the field scale, was deemed to be important. If we want to understand what's going on at the field scale, we first, of course, need to understand what's going on at all the smaller scales. 3, it was thought that the distribution and mass transfer behavior of immiscible liquids in heterogeneous systems, particularly low permeability or fracture systems, still requires a lot of investigation. Continuing on slide 11, another important component of this system is so-called long-term mass flux behavior. So if we are interested in the mass flux reduction, mass removal relationship, and we want to monitor the system over long time periods, which, as we know, will usually be required, we need to understand what contributes to long-term mass flux behavior, including components of aging, the relative contributions of immiscible liquid that are trapped in poorly accessible regions, such as inside of lower permeability units, for example, the relative contributions of contaminant mass that's sorbed to the soil particles, and what is referred to as matrix-associated dissolved mass, or the mass that's dissolved in water that's residing within lower permeability units and is not directly affected by advective transport. Another area of interest is the impact of co-contaminants on phase properties such as wettability, interfacial tension in these complex natural settings. And then finally, issues related to mathematical modeling at multiple scales and the inherent need for some type of upscaling. So coming back now to mass flux on slide 12, we're referring to the massive contamination that's residing in the aqueous phase emanating from our source zone. On slide 13, I've presented what's becoming a key aspect of this source zone issue. This referred to in various terms as mass flux reduction, mass removal relationship. So I'll take a couple of minutes to discuss this slide in little detail. So this relationship is of interest so that we can understand and hopefully predict in the future, as Jim was discussing, what degree of reduction we would expect to obtain from doing some type of source zone mass removal action. So we see two lines here, two curves. The blue curve on the right-hand side represents the hypothetical relationship between flux reduction and mass removal for so-called ideal mass transfer conditions. So these ideal conditions would comprise, for example, a homogeneous porous medium with immiscible liquid distributed uniformly throughout the medium and with mass transfer processes such as dissolution occurring under local equilibrium conditions. So everything as ideal as possible. So under these conditions, we approach the closest ideal condition for removing mass because we maximize and maintain the maximum concentration in the aqueous phase as possible. Of course, this ideal mass transfer condition is not very ideal for a flux reduction relationship if we want to have flux reduction occurring as soon as possible or with as little mass removed as possible because of the very same reasons that concentrations remain high for long times. So on the other hand, we have the red curve, which represents the hypothetical behavior for non-ideal conditions, which would, for example, represent non-uniform distribution of immiscible liquid in a heterogeneous porous medium with mass transfer processes such as dissolution occurring under rate-limited conditions. So under these conditions, the concentrations are not maintained at their maximum for long times, and therefore we get inefficient mass removal. However, that leads to our more ideal mass flux reduction type relationship. So moving to slide 14, some of the primary factors influencing the mass flux behavior for a site would, of course, be the flow field dynamics associated with flow and permeability field, the distribution and configuration of the immiscible liquid, whether it's uniformly distributed in relatively residual concentration, residual saturations, or maybe it's much more localized distribution and occurs as pools, etc. Then dissolution dynamics, and then other mass transfer and transformation processes. So one key aspect of this entire issue, slide 15, is measuring mass flux. And I won't focus on this because this is the topic for Lynn and Michael in the second presentation. So not to limit this at all, it's very critical to the whole issue, but they will be speaking about that. So in slide 16, another key component is predicting the mass flux reduction. So again, if we at some point would be able to predict the degree of mass flux that could be achieved with a certain amount of mass removal for a particular site, I think we could all see the benefit to being able to do that. So we want to understand these flux reduction mass removal relationships. And again, to understand those relationships, we need to understand source zone architecture and dynamics and how that influences mass flux. And so this is a high priority research need for the next few years, as Jim was mentioning. So there are several ways that we can look at trying to understand these source zone architecture dynamics impacts on mass flux, mass removal relationships. One front for this current research is based on mathematical modeling. And so there's been several contributions made, and we foresee much more coming from modeling efforts, but I will not focus on those today. A second effort is, of course, related to field-based work, which Lynn and Michael, again, will speak to. A third approach is shown on slide 17, and this is to do laboratory-based investigations. So one particular type of laboratory-based investigation would be so-called intermediate-scale experiments, where we use flow cells or other larger devices that allow us the opportunity to examine heterogeneous systems, the influence of permeability variability, non-uniform immiscible liquid distributions, and multiple mass transfer processes on mass removal and mass flux. And in these systems, we can define them and control them relatively well, and hopefully we can then evaluate and characterize these flux mass removal relationships. So I will give a couple of examples now based on this type of laboratory-based investigation. So in slide 18, we here at U of A have been collaborating with the Pacific National Labs working to investigate this mass flux, mass removal relationship by conducting experiments in flow cells where we can have multiple methods to measure the aqueous concentrations emanating from the source zone. So in essence, the mass flux, we can use depth-specific ports, vertically integrated ports, and then, of course, collect flow cell effluent. In addition to monitoring aqueous concentrations and mass flux, we're using a method, in this case, dual energy gamma system, to determine the immiscible liquid saturation in situ, to measure it before, during, and after the experiment, so that we can monitor quantitatively the mass, distribution, and configuration of the immiscible liquid during the dissolution experiment. And this will hopefully allow us to correlate the mass removal behavior to mass flux behavior that we observe by monitoring the aqueous concentrations. And there's additional characterization methods that can be done in these types of systems. So on slide 19, here's an example of one of our initial studies done as primarily a proof of concept. You can see very simplistic orthogonal type configuration here. We have two zones. In the middle, you see rectangular boxes. We had residual saturation of trichloroethene TCE in the top zone and in the bottom zone. In the top zone, it's a 20-30 mesh sand, which is the same as the surrounding matrix. The lower zone, zone 1, comprised a 70 mesh sand, so smaller particle size. And then you can see the different types of monitoring locations. We had those little dots represented, for example, by A and C, represent the point samples that you might get such as with an MLS system. Then we have K and J, which would be representative of fully screened monitoring wells, and then we have the extraction well. So with this system, you can see a photograph in slide 20. The dimensions are a couple of meters long by a meter high. You can see the two zones of TCE contamination that were dyed red in the center there. So we have now some results on slide 21. These are the aqueous concentrations for some of the different ports. You can see the concentrations close to solubility for port E, which is just down gradient of that upper zone, which was in the same porous medium as the surrounding matrix. So as we'd expect, very close to source of immiscible liquid, we see close to saturation concentrations. But then you can see we have much lower concentrations for some of the other ports due to dilution effects. Now, with the gamma system, as I said, we could monitor residual saturation of TCE in situ, and this is shown on slide 22 with this false color representation, with purple representing zero residual saturation and red representing the highest, around 10-12% residual saturation. So this data here represents the upper zone, which again was in the same sand as the matrix, so we have basically uniform flow through that zone. The upper diagram shows the initial condition, then the lower diagram shows the distribution of TCE after we stopped the experiment after a week or so of dissolution. So you can see that the left-hand side up gradient edge, we had the dissolution front move relatively uniformly into that source zone because we had relatively uniform flow through that system. So we get the results that we'd expect. In slide 23 are the results for the lower zone, which was in the lower permeability unit. And so in this case, we would have flow going primarily around that zone, which we confirmed with the results of the dye tests and tracer tests. And so in this case, you can see in the lower diagram, at the end of the experiment, we had much less removal of the immiscible liquid because, again, the water is not flushing through this zone. It was primarily moving around it, and so we got minimal direct contact of the advective water with the immiscible liquid. So now we're continuing this work, doing more realistic configurations and going out to complete removal so we can characterize the mass flux, mass removal relationships. In the meantime, on slide 24, I'm showing some results from one-dimensional column experiments looking at mass flux reduction versus mass removal, where it's relatively simple to get complete mass removed. And we can see even in these simple one-dimensional column systems, we can get quite interesting behavior. So the blue dots represent the results of an experiment conducted with a nice, uniform, well-sorted sand. So the particle size distribution is very small, packed in a column with immiscible liquid uniformly distributed throughout the column and then flushed with water and monitored. And so you can see that the data there are pretty close to that blue line, the ideal mass transfer case that I showed earlier. So we can see and obtain this ideal mass transfer behavior, this and so-called non-ideal mass flux reduction mass removal relationship under ideal conditions. The red data represent another one-dimensional system, but in this case we used a poorly sorted sand, so the particle size distribution was greater, and so we hypothesize that as a result the immiscible liquid blobs are more non-uniformly distributed. And in this case we can see that we start getting mass flux reduction at around 60% mass removal rather than 80 to 90%. In slide 25 is another set of column data, but in this case we're comparing a homogeneous system to a system where we have one low permeability unit in the center of the column and the immiscible liquid resides just within that lower permeability unit. And so now we see mass flux reduction starts approximately at 20% mass removed. And so out in the field, we'd expect these relationships to fluctuate somewhere between the two extreme cases I showed on the other slide, and Lynn will show some examples of that. So on slide 26 now, moving on from laboratory intermediate scale, column scale research, I'll finish up with a little bit about some pore scale research now that's becoming of great interest in the last few years. There's several groups now looking at these issues of, for example, multi-phase fluid displacement in porous media, the influence of wetting and non-wetting conditions on fluid distributions, and particularly interfacial areas between immiscible fluids, and how that influences mass transfer processes. So there's two primary means by which this pore scale research is being conducted now. One is using pore scale modeling based on using network models or lattice Boltzmann models, etc. And there's very exciting results coming from that work. I won't focus on that now. Another focus is high resolution imaging using MRI or NMR methods or X-ray methods. And so I will finish up with an example of this high-resolution imaging. Slide 27, we've been conducting imaging work at the Geosoil EnviroCARS facility at the APS in Argonne National Labs in Illinois. This is synchrotron-based research facility supported by NSF and DOE in the state of Illinois. So the idea here is we pack small columns with porous media and immiscible liquid. Then we take them to the facility, and with their synchrotron-based X-ray with very high energies, we can image that porous media and have resolutions currently at around 10 micrometer, which is sufficient for us to image and see individual blobs of immiscible liquid at the pore scale. And so an example of this kind of data that we obtain is shown in slide 28. So I didn't put the scale here, but those columns, we're looking at a cross-section cut through one of our columns that were imaged, and that's a 5 millimeter diameter. So on the left-hand side is the type of raw image we get from a cross-section, again, of a column where the solids, porous media solids, are in dark gray, the water is black, and then, in this case, PCE, tetrachloroethene, is the immiscible liquid, and that's white. So we can see individual blobs of the immiscible liquid, and we can see that they're not all the same size or shape. They're not all single little spherical blobs stuck in the middle of a pore, but you can see small singlets all the way to much more complex blobs. And then on the right-hand side, just to help visualize, is a false color composite of the phases. So after we have this type of image data, we can process it, and an example would be in slide 29. We've selected individual blobs now that we've gone through with a three-dimensional software program to identify each individual blob and then to characterize it in terms of volume and size and surface area, for example. And so you can see here a range of configurations and complexities of these immiscible liquid blobs, all the way from the upper left corner, a nice single sphere, to what we call a doublet on the upper right side, then to a more complex ganglia in the lower left, to then on the lower right, a very, very complex multi-ganglia network of immiscible liquid. Then on to slide 30, we can do time series studies with the same column during a course of dissolution, flushing with water, causing dissolution and mass removal. We can image it at different times, and then that will allow us to characterize blob configuration during mass removal, to hopefully then characterize and understand the mass flux reduction which we get from monitoring the effluent from these columns versus mass removal behavior. And I'm just showing an example here, the same zone circled in red at three different image times. You can see the size of the immiscible liquid blobs decreasing as we continue to flush the column. And so going on then to slide 31, I'd like to acknowledge the NIHS, SBRP, and several of my students and collaborators. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Brousseau. It was a very interesting talk. We'll open up for questions in just a minute. I'd like to remind the Internet participants that at the top of the slides, there's a question mark, and you can submit your questions via that form. We'll read those questions out to today's speakers. If you're on the phone lines, actually, let me remove our lecture mode so we won't have all of your phone lines muted. Okay, we've unmuted today's phone participants' lines, and if we could ask each of you to put your phones on mute unless you're asking the question, that will help us to keep the noise down that's broadcast to the seminar. If you have a question for Dr. Brousseau, you can take your phone off mute, and please introduce yourself and name your organization and ask your question. Jim?
Go ahead.
Jim, if you'd if you've got a question, we can squeeze you in here until we get our participants to begin with their questions.
All right. That's one of my first questions, Mark, was on your slide 30.
Jim, volume is a little bit low.
On slide 30, Mark, I was wondering, you said flushing. Was this just a water flush that you were monitoring as opposed
yes.
to a solvent? Okay.
That's
and,
correct.
For purposes of, it looks very interesting work. Maybe you presented it in Arizona and I just wasn't paying attention. Could this process also perhaps distinguish distribution of an active remediation agent like a permanganate or a persulfate or a Would that show up as yet a fourth, between the solid phase, the liquid phase, and the NAPL phase?
Yes, that's possible, and we're planning to look into that in future experiments. For example, to flush with a solubilization agent, or as you mentioned, permanganate, to look at the pore scale distribution of the reagent and look at areas of contact and no contact, for example, between the reagent solution and the immiscible liquid.
That would be very useful if that were possible.
Yes.
Jim, perhaps you could repeat your request earlier that you made for sites for applications?
Well, as I say, anybody that has sites that are either undergoing active remediation or that would be candidates for either trying technologies with some synergistic potential or where there's a plume that's simple enough that we could model an instrument or monitor an instrument, that would be very helpful as we continue this national dialogue on the utility or futility of source reduction. I had one other question, Mark, about this dual energy gamma system. Is this something that we should perhaps be discussing in a different context for possible applications at larger scale, or is this such a high-energy process that it can only be done in a laboratory setting?
Well, in this particular setup that we're using, it would pretty much be restricted to laboratory settings. But we could go larger or smaller with the flow cells, for example. So I think, for example, in Germany, they have a mega flow cell system that they've been working on for several years now.
Are you talking about the Vegas system?
Yes, and so I believe in that one or another one they've been using, I don't recall if it was dual energy gamma or X-ray, but some method for in situ measurement of immiscible liquid saturation.
Okay, let's open it up for questions back to our phone participants. If you have a question for Dr. Brousseau, please take your phone off mute and introduce yourself and name your organization and ask your question.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi.
Dick Kohler, EPA Region 1.
Go ahead, Dick.
Going back to slides 19 to 23, when you have two different media based on sand sieve size, are there any plans to try and expand on that work so that if we have a layered system and we know that we have either source or high dissolved concentrations that were around such layers as you have developed in your model there, and we can predict how long it will take for the more tightly or smaller size, grain size material to be flushed? In other words, you're looking at your mass flux going down because and the mass removal being slow, but it's when we clean out the highly permeable zones, we're left with all these recalcitrant zones, which is what you've illustrated here. Is there any work going to be done saying that if you characterize the geology such that you can create a volume of these recalcitrant zones, you will then be able to predict a flushing time?
Well, you really hit it right on the head there with that question, because that's really one of the primary goals of what people are trying to do with this research. And so, yes, we specifically here are looking into that question, and I mentioned with this work here that we're continuing on now with some more, quote, realistic type distributions or configurations of porous media, and thus exactly what we're trying to look at. And also to reemphasize your point is up there in, let's see, which slide? Slide 10, I mentioned that at the VNAPL workshop, we felt that this issue of immiscible liquid residing within low permeability or fractured systems was one of the key components that really hadn't been addressed, at least to our thoughts, adequately yet. And at the workshop, there were a lot of discussion about all the different scenarios where we could expect to have immiscible liquid reside within lower permeability units, and that the original kind of simplistic model that even in the saturated zone that immiscible liquid would only reside in the higher permeability units is pretty outmoded. And so I go right along with your question, and yes, we are trying to address that issue.
Thank you. I have a question here from Jim Hatton at EarthTech in Greenwood Village, Colorado. Given that extracting product could result in a higher surface area of the product, such as going from near saturation to residual saturation, could extracting product result in a higher mass flux leaving the source area?
Yeah, so that's a good question, and I don't think there's sufficient information at the field to really answer that yet. Hopefully information will be available in the future, but I believe some of the flow cell intermediate scale work that Susan Powers did a few years ago with her grad student illustrated that effect, where the concentrations, aqueous concentrations, coming out, emanating from a source zone were relatively low initially, and then after some mass removal occurred, concentrations did go up for a while. And so given that the flux reduction is essentially just the inverse of the concentration change, then yes, we would have seen on the plot of that data the kind of relationship that you mentioned. So this mass flux reduction, mass removal relationship is quite complex behavior, I believe, and still a lot to understand about it.
Actually, and this is Jim Cummings, it was reported at the recent Battelle Bio Conference where a fair number of presenters discussed in-situ chemical oxidation. We've seen now at numerous chemical oxidation projects that shortly after the application of the first or second round, actually, generally speaking, the second round of the oxidant, seeing significant concentration increases or mass flux increases. And it's thought to be possible that you're seeing increased desorption of the what it was otherwise sorbed phase contaminant in the volume of the dissolved phase plume. In fact, the Navy's, it's even gotten far enough along that the Navy's included a discussion of it in their one of their tech transfer websites. So I think it's not only possible, but we're seeing it happen. In fact, that may not necessarily be bad. If the questioner wanted to have a follow-up question, whether he thought that was good or bad, I would say that, again, if you're trying to accelerate the time frame for remediation and have your capture systems in place, that's what's exactly what you're trying to do, is accelerate the flux and thereby accelerate the time frame for restoration.
Thank you, Jim. That brings up a good point. The questioner, Mr. Hatton, if you'd like to follow up with that, of course, you can submit another question today, and also the contacts for today's speakers, as well as for myself, are available on the webpage where you registered for this event. So if you have a question that comes up later, please feel free to contact us. Let's go back and check with the phone lines again. If there is a phone line participant with a question, please take your phone off mute and introduce yourself and name the organization and ask your question.
If no one else has a question, this is John Studi with the Department of Toxics in California.
Please.
I had a question about the PNL experiments with a dual energy gamma system. Is there someone there that could answer questions about what the gamma sources were and the energies that were used for that dual energy?
Well, it was a cesium and americium sources. I don't recall right now what settings we ran them at, but if I believe there's a way you can email me questions, I could get back to you with specifics whatever you had.
Yeah, I'd just like to know more about that dual energy system.
Okay.
You can contact Dr. Brousseau. He can get you some more information, I believe he said. Let's stay with the phone line participants. If there's another questioner, please take your phone off mute and introduce yourself and your organization and ask your question.
Yes, this is Kevin Brewer at the Savannah Riverside. I had a question about Flight 25.
Okay.
Go ahead, sir.
I'm trying to understand the way that the Dean Apple was loaded into the column.
Okay.
And then subsequently flushed. Primarily I'm trying to get at is the red curve, the red dots indicating a curve where it's actually, you're getting flushing initially of Dean Apple because of the way it was loaded, and then it kind of stabilizes for a while and then goes back to that ideal situation where you don't get any mass flux reduction, any significant mass flux reduction, and so you get almost complete source removal.
Yes, so with respect to that set of experiments, the heterogeneous system comprised one cube, if you will, of lower permeability sand centered in a matrix of coarser sand, so would have a higher permeability. And the immiscible liquid occurred only inside of the lower permeability cube, which was in the center of the column. And then we flushed, let the column sit a little while, then we started flushing it with water continuously.
So if you were trying to recreate maybe the original loading in a field site, you didn't actually recreate that, but would you think that the after a period of time of fluxing water through the system, you would end up with more of a equilibrium of an apple?
I'm not quite sure what you mean. In this case, because we have the immiscible liquid trapped only in the lower permeability unit, then similar to that larger flow cell experiment for the lower zone case, the water flowing through the system effectively primarily moves around that cube. So there's not a large amount of advection through the cube. There is some advection, but it's much lower than the advective rate around the cube. And so we have a little bit of advective dissolution mass transfer behavior occurring within the cube, but we also have a lot of the overall mass removal behavior is limited by dissolution and then diffusion from that zone into the coarser zone where we have the primary advection occurring. And so that behavior then is related to this non-uniform flow behavior going on, and we have some limitation of mass transfer coming from this poor contact between advecting water and the trapped immiscible liquid that we don't have in the homogeneous case. But you're right, we set this up to have as ideal conditions defined as possible. So as I mentioned, when we're moving on with our more current studies, we're trying to get closer and closer to representing what we might expect in the field site, where we would have immiscible liquid distributed in a number of configurations and locations, and also have dissolved mass mixed in the source zone as well.
Great, thanks.
Okay.
Hey, let's stay with our phone line participants. If you have a question, take your phone off mute and introduce yourself and your organization and ask your question. Okay, while we're waiting for our phone line participants, we'll come back to them in just a minute as we conclude this first question and answer period. But I do have another question here from one of our internet participants. This is from Marcus van Zutphen from Tau Rotterdam in the Netherlands. And he asks, regarding slide 21, based on the concentrations of the TCE in the three monitoring wells, the concentrations do decline. Could you explain why the concentrations in the extraction well stays relatively constant? And could this be explained for field measurements of extraction wells and monitoring wells?
Okay, thank you. Yes, as I was saying earlier, I didn't really go into individual details, but again, that concentration for port E, that's the port, if you look on slide 19, that port is central down gradient of zone 2, where we had nice uniform flow through that zone, and we had fairly uniform mass transfer dissolution behavior, as we saw from the dual energy gamma data in slide 22. Then we look at, for example, port F, where we see concentrations starting around 400 milligrams per liter, and port F is the one that's down gradient of zone 1, where we did not have the ideal dissolution mass transfer behavior because of the non-uniform flow around that lower permeability unit. So we can see the effect there directly on aqueous concentrations and mass flux, the influence of non-uniform flow and non-uniform immiscible liquid distribution. Then if we look at port J, which is also down gradient of zone 1, we see the concentrations for port J are much, much lower than they are for port F, both of which are down gradient of the same zone. And so in this case, we're seeing for port J the additional effect of dilution coming from the fact that port J is screened over a large interval and includes zones where there was no immiscible liquid, both above and below zone 1. And then, as you rightly pointed out, if we look finally at the concentrations for the extraction well, we see that those concentrations are lower than the port E concentrations and a little bit lower than the port J, but higher, excuse me, port F, but higher than port J. And so the extraction well concentrations are, of course, integrating all mass and dissolution behavior going on in that entire system. And so we can see then the effects of everything going on with respect to the non-uniform immiscible liquid dissolution and distribution, and the effect of non-uniform flow with the low permeability zone, and then dilution effects from the extraction well concentration data. So I'm not sure, but hopefully I've answered the question, but we expect the same type of behavior just scaled up in the field, and we've seen that type of behavior, and others have as well, of course.
Thanks, Dr. Brousseau. We'd like to end this first question and answer period here in the next couple of minutes, and we'll move on to the second half of today's presentation. But let me go back to the phone participants one more time, and if anyone has a question, take your phone off mute and introduce yourself and your organization and ask your question. Okay, seems like this might be a good time to go ahead and move on. If you have any further questions that come up, please continue to submit them across the webpage using the question mark that you see at the top of the presentation. Or you can send questions directly to me or today's speakers via their contacts that you'll find on the seminar registration page. I would at this time like to turn it back over to Jim Cummings for any more comments before Dr. Wood and Dr. Brooks.
Thank you. Actually, I've pretty much highlighted some of the areas that are of particular interest to us in the mass flux area, and that is some of the practical and financial considerations that are going to be involved in bringing the tool along and determining whether it does as many things for us as it might do to us. Obviously, we're looking for tools that increase the signal-to-noise ratio in our system that unfortunately currently is affected by some fairly high static, and we certainly don't want to be adopting and using tools that just add additional sources of noise to the system. And so I really appreciate the work that Dr. Wood's been doing at Fort Lewis that he'll be telling us about and funded through the CERTA PSTCP program. So the next presentation will be on the mass flux tools and his work in the field, and we'll give you some information on the different approaches that are currently extant to try to perform mass flux measurements and the limitations and advantages of those tools. And I think it's fair to say that in the context of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, I think it is in fact fair to say that it is a phenomena. Mass flux is in fact a phenomena that is affected by the very act of measuring it, which is going to be one of the challenges to be able to normalize our systems and calibrate for those sorts of perturbations. So this presentation will be by Dr. Lynn Wood and Dr. Michael Brooks from our ADA lab. Dr. Wood is a soil scientist in our groundwater and ecosystems restoration division at the R.S. Kerr Research Lab in Ada, Oklahoma. His recent research involves development and evaluation of innovative technologies for characterization and remediation of BAPL-contaminated soils and dissolved phase aquifer contamination. He's field tested a number of innovative techniques for extracting apples, including solubilization, mobilization, and volatilization of the contaminants. Dr. Brooks is a recent accession to our lab. He's a postdoctoral environmental engineer in the subsurface remediation branch at the Kerr Lab, and he's been engaged in contaminant characterization remediation work for over a decade in private, academic, and government sectors. Lynn, it's all yours.
Thanks, Jim. Well, Mark gave us a fundamental overview of the processes influencing and determining DNAPL dissolution and mass transfer. And so what I want to do is try to build on that and talk, as Jim said, about the measurement of contaminant flux and, of course, the processes that Mark talked about influence and determine what the contaminant flux will be. So we'll talk about that in some of our work in the use of contaminant flux as measured in the field. So if we go to slide 33, what I want to begin with just giving a quick survey of the methods that are currently available for estimating mass flux in the field. And specifically, we'll look at multi-level sampler transects, passive flux meters, and horizontal flow treatment wells, what's known as the integral pumping test, and method that we're looking at, which I've called modified integral pumping test, which is built on the work done by the folks in Germany. And then Michael Brooks will talk about an application using mass flux as a performance metric. And so if we go to slide 34, conventional methods of measuring flux have involved the collection of groundwater samples from wells or, as shown here, multi-level samplers, often in placed along transects perpendicular to the groundwater flow. Contaminant concentrations then are obtained from samples that are combined with groundwater fluxes that are estimated from independent data. And all of this information then is used to calculate mass fluxes, contaminant mass fluxes. And again, this is a conventional technology that's been around for some time and used. And as I cite here, API has a publication that Chuck Newell and others put together in 2003 that describes this technology and this technique in more detail. If we go to slide 35, list here some of the advantages and disadvantages of this method. First of all, you generate spatial information on concentration from this, particularly if you are using MLSs where you have multiple points, vertical points of measurement. You can get both vertical and lateral spatial information on contaminant fluxes. These methods are amenable to uncertainty estimation, and this has been done to estimate the errors and uncertainty associated with measurement of mass flux with this technique. Another advantage certainly is that this method produces very small volumes of waste that have to be dealt with. And then finally, it is listed here, it's a conventional method. In other words, there's some level of comfort because of the experience that we have with this. Some of the disadvantages of the method is that it requires an independent estimate of water flux. You don't get this directly from the test, so you have to rely on some additional information, either pump test or some other information or data that you might be able to collect on the field to determine what the water flux hydraulic conductivities are and some estimate of the distribution or variability of those. Then also, these are really point measurements both in space and time. So you're measuring small volumes or the aquifer with these samples, particularly if you're using the MLSs, and these are short-term samples. So again, essentially point measurements in space and time. And as a result, it interrogates, as I say here, very small volumes of the aquifer, so you don't get the advantage of the volume integration that you do with some of the other methods that we'll talk about. And because of that, then the data have to be spatially integrated in order to get information about the contaminant mass flows across this transect, and that's certainly not a simple or necessarily a straightforward thing to do. Okay, now if we go to slide 36, a recently proposed method incorporates the use of horizontal flow treatment wells. In this method, we have two wells placed at some distance apart. Each well has two screened intervals. One well is operated in an upflow mode and the other well in a downflow mode so that you basically get circulation of water below the surface. And then with this method, prior to pumping, heads are measured in the wells and at least one observation well, and then groundwater samples are collected to assess the contaminant concentrations in the formation. And then head measurements or tracer test results are used during steady state flow to determine hydraulic conductivity, which of course is the remaining parameter required for mass flux estimates. And again, this is a relatively new approach that's being investigated by Mark Goltz and some of his colleagues. And they've done some initial testing in some model aquifers, which indicate they get good results when compared to known fluxes in these artificial systems. So if we go to the next slide, slide 37, we list some of the advantages and disadvantages of this proposed method. First of all, an advantage of this method is that it generates water flux and contaminant mass flux estimates both. So you get both information about water flux and contaminant flux from the technique. And it's not necessary to rely on independent or other information for the water fluxes as you would have to do in the more conventional method. It also interrogates large volumes of the aquifer, so you get a spatially integrated measure of the flux in the system. And it can be used in deep aquifers. And perhaps one of the biggest advantages of this method is that you are not extracting groundwater, so you don't have the waste to deal with here. Everything is left below surface. You can also get estimates of both horizontal and vertical aquifer conductivities with the method because of the design of the flow system, the flow pattern. Some disadvantages then are it doesn't give you that spatial information because of you're integrating over this larger areas and they're for it's difficult to quantify the uncertainty associated with these measurements. It also assumes aquifer homogeneity in the application of this technique. A potential disadvantage, although not necessarily particularly significant one, in my opinion, is that it uses tracers to estimate interflow, or can use. Mark and his group has also used this multi-dipole technique where you monitor the heads, the mounding, and the drawdown in the wells as they're pumped. But the more reliable method appears to get hydraulic conductivity information appears to be the use of tracers. And in using tracers, obviously you're injecting a chemical into the subsurface, which can create concerns, obviously. But these typically can be fairly inert type compounds. The technique does not function in all wells. In other words, it has to be specifically designed for this type of application. And so it almost certainly would require, at least at most sites, the installation of wells in order to do this, and wells specifically designed for this purpose. And the final one, disadvantage listed here, is it underestimates maximum resident contaminant concentration. And again, I'm not sure this is really a significant disadvantage, simply because I think this perhaps could be said of all the flux measurement techniques here. If you're measuring concentrations, the maximum concentration, of course, that you're going to measure is the maximum that's in the formation that you're monitoring. And so there's a likelihood, even if you're doing point measurements, that you're getting some bias toward a lower concentration. This doesn't necessarily mean, though, that you'll be underestimating mass fluxes. Mass fluxes could be either under or overestimated. So again, I don't think this is a particularly significant disadvantage for this technology. Moving on to slide 38 then. Another method that's been introduced by the folks at the University of Florida, Kirk Hadfield, Mike Annable, and Suresh Rao, is known as the passive flux meter technique, and this uses a sorbent onto which a tracer has been loaded that's placed in a well. The sorbent is separated typically in vertical intervals, as shown here in this slide, and there are usually washers or separators between those intervals to minimize vertical flow and facilitate vertical resolution. And so, again, you can get information about the vertical distribution of contaminant flux and groundwater flux as well here. As we go to slide 39, I just presents a schematic here that shows, illustrates as groundwater flows through the sorbent under natural gradient conditions, in this case with this particular test, the tracers are eluted from the sorbent, and again, these tracers are loaded on prior to insertion of the sorbent into the well. But as groundwater flows through it, the sorbents are eluted off of the tracers are eluted off of the sorbent, and contaminant is sorbed then, or loaded onto the sorbent. Depletion of the tracer then provides data by which groundwater flow can be estimated, and then this, along with the contaminant mass loading onto the sorbent, allows calculation of mass flux and allows the calculation of mass flux for each of these vertical segments. Moving on to slide 40, again, some of the advantages and disadvantages of this technique. First of all, it generates spatial information on both cumulative water and contaminant mass flux, the method is amenable to uncertainty estimation, and the folks, Kirk and his colleagues, have done this with this method, and again, they looking at laboratory type systems and comparing it to known fluxes, it's performed well under those conditions. The method generates local estimation of horizontal aquifer conductivity, and as we've talked about the issue of waste, this method generates only small amounts of waste, and that's predominantly the sorbent, the waste sorbent, which is typically activated carbon, but you're not pumping water from the well that has to be dealt with and disposed of. It's a passive method. There's minimal disturbance of the flow. There's no pumping in this system. Typically, the flux meters are installed in a well, left there for a period of time that's a function of both the groundwater velocity and the contaminant, anticipated contaminant loading, and then you know, sometime later, days or a week or more later, you return and remove these sorbents and the meters and sample them. You know, again, it's a passive technique. The method can be relatively inexpensive. Of course, the function of the number of these that you would install and the type of sorbent and so forth, but certainly, again, you don't have to deal with the waste. Some disadvantages is that it only interrogates a small volume of the aquifer. It's more akin to the point type measurements, and so therefore the data has to be spatially integrated to get information about contaminant flux or water flux across the transect. It uses, again, resid tracers, which similar to what I talked about before, a potential problem with introducing chemicals into the subsurface. And again, it doesn't function in all wells. I have to be concerned about some well that's in screen configurations that you might get significant flow bypassing and so forth, and I have to be concerned about flow convergence or divergence at the well. Okay, moving on to then slide 41. This is an illustration of the integral pumping test that Jim mentioned earlier in his introductory remarks. This is a method that's been developed by the folks in Germany. It's another dynamic or pumping test. In this test, contaminant mass loading is determined by a collection of concentration time series information during pumping. The tests then are designed to achieve complete capture flow along the control plane. And the concentration time series data are used then to infer information about contaminant distribution. As Jim suggested, this has been applied a number of times in Europe and probably primarily for evaluation of natural attenuation processes. So if we go to slide 42 and look at the advantages and disadvantages of this technique, it generates contaminant mass flow estimates, and that's done relatively straightforwardly. And it also, again, interrogates large volumes of the aquifer. Substantial pumping is used to integrate over these large volumes of the aquifer, and it can be used in deep aquifers. Some disadvantages are that it is or can be costly, and this is largely due to the wastewater disposal issue, and in some cases that may not be significant if there are treatment processes that are available that can handle it, but it's certainly an issue with this and any of the pumping methods that actually extract water from the surface is an issue that has to be considered before the application of the technology. It can and often requires relatively long times to run the test, to pump the volumes that are necessary to get the capture that you want. It assumes, as some of the other tests do, that the aquifer is homogeneous, and you don't get estimates, direct estimates of water flux from this technique. So that component of mass flux, the water flux part of it, has to be derived from independent information or data that you obtain from the site. And again, it doesn't provide the spatial information that some of the other techniques might, and makes it difficult to quantify uncertainty. Then it's subject to limitations of the sampling configuration, and again, I'm not sure this is in many cases a very significant disadvantage, but the temporal and spatial configuration of the system, of the sampling system, can affect the concentration time series data for this technique, and that needs to be realized and considered. Again, similar to what I mentioned before, I don't really think the underestimation of the maximum resident contaminant concentration is a particular or particularly significant disadvantage. It probably should be recognized that this is typically the case, but again, it doesn't mean that you're underestimating the mass flux with the technology. So going on to the final technology that I want to talk about on slide 43, and this is what I'm calling here the modified integral pumping test. Our research team is currently evaluating this technology, and again, it's a modified version, basically, of the German IPT. And this technique allows estimation of Darcy velocities directly from the test results. And as with the IPT, contaminant concentration information is obtained by collecting groundwater samples from pumping wells as a function of time. The wells are installed then along a transect perpendicular to the flow, and heads are monitored in pumping wells and down gradient observation wells during groundwater extraction. If we go to the next slide, slide 44, under the assumption of uniform flow, Darcy velocity, or Q-naught, as shown here, can be estimated directly when heads in the pumping observation wells are equal, and use the equation shown in the lower right-hand part of this graph to calculate Darcy velocity under these conditions. And Michael Brooks has been a key person in developing and testing this method, and he'll show some results from the field a bit later for both this method and the passive flux meter technology. So if we go to slide 45, in practice, the tests consist of simultaneously pumping from wells along the transect at sequentially increasing pumping rates while monitoring heads and collecting samples from the extracted water. And again, from this we get information about concentration time series and can estimate groundwater fluxes as well. So if we look at some of the advantages and disadvantages of this in slide 46, we are able to generate information, of course, on contaminant mass flow estimates and water flux as well. As with the more conventional or the earlier IPT, it integrates large volumes of the aquifer because of the pumping, and it can be used in deep aquifers. Disadvantages, again, largely because we're pumping water that has to be dealt with, it can be costly the installation, of course, of a number of wells along the transect is a significant expense as well. It requires some time to execute this, although typically probably a shorter period of time than perhaps the more conventional IPT. We attempt to minimize the flow rates so that the wastes are minimized, but there still can be significant volumes of waste to deal with. It assumes aqua homogeneity as several of these techniques do, and again, doesn't provide the spatial information and makes it difficult to assess uncertainty. It's perhaps somewhat limited to sampling configuration and the temporal spatial configuration can affect the data, but probably less significantly than just the standard IPT test.
Hunterwood, excuse me, pardon me for interrupting. I've had a couple of notes to ask you to speak up a little bit louder from some of our internet participants.
Okay, I'll move a little closer to the speaker as well.
That will probably fix it. Thank you.
Okay. So let's go to slide 47. What I want to do now is to change focus a bit and talk about application of mass flux information here to assess performance and effectiveness of DNAPL source remediation. And this is some work that we currently have underway that's funded by both EPA and the Department of Defense through their CERTA program. So if we go to slide 47, in essence, as Mark has already discussed, source remediation really is a function of both groundwater flow and contaminant concentrations and the correlation between these the flow and contaminant flux. So the relationship between mass reduction and flux response that Mark talked about will be site-specific. And in essence, then we can view source remediation as a means of managing contaminant flux. And if we go to slide 49, then because dissolved plume properties such as size, shape, and contaminant mass are defined largely by contaminant loading from the source, and the attenuation capacity of the system, a reduction in mass flux is expected to cause changes in the plume. And these changes may or may not result in regulatory compliance. And so what we're attempting to do with some of our field work is not only evaluate some of these mass flux measurement technologies, but to use them to assess the impact and the performance of DNAPL source remediation technologies. So if we go to slide 50, again, this is work, the work that we'll be talking about through the remainder of the presentation is work that's funded by EPA and CERTIP, and we're working with several other folks on our research team from various universities, University of Florida, Clemson, University Purdue, as well as the Air Force Institute of Technology. A list of the team members, principal team members, are shown on slide 51 here, and these are key people in the work that we're doing. This is really a project that involves not only the field work, some of which we'll talk about today, but also laboratory investigations, some of which are similar to the types of things that Mark had described earlier, as well as modeling efforts. We're trying to combine all of these to better understand contaminant flux and how it can be used as a performance metric and what really the impact is of some of these source remediation technologies and moving us toward the achievement of regulatory goals. Okay, slide 52 then just shows a map which lists field sites that we're working at in this process of attempting to measure the performance of Dean Apple source remediation. Michael will talk about data from at least a couple of these sites, Fort Lewis, I think, and as well as Hill Air Force Base. And Michael is really our lead person. He and Mike Anvil are taking the lead on the field efforts of measuring contaminant mass flux and assessing remedial performance. And Michael, especially the lead on these pumping technologies. And so at this point, I'll turn the presentation over to Michael and let him talk about some of this field.
Thank you, Lynn. As Lynn just mentioned, we're going to present selected results now from two of the four sites. And if you move to slide 53, I have to apologize for the quality of that slide. That was originally an animated graphic that didn't quite make it through the conversion process to a web-based presentation. But the geology at the Hill site consists of a shallow sand and gravel aquifer, which is underlain by a thick clay unit. That contour map that you see in slide 53 is the top of that clay unit. The Dean Apple source area is located on the left side of the figure in that depression shown by the gray region. Groundwater flows from left to right, as indicated by the red arrow, through a transect of 10 wells, which you can see, unfortunately, they're underneath the blue square, but the wells are actually represented by the short yellow line. Those wells are spaced approximately 10 feet apart, and as you can kind of discern from the graphic, they span a saddle created by the clay surface. And so the geology of this site actually helps to ensure that groundwater flows through our well transect in a perpendicular fashion. If you move on to slide 54, this slide here summarizes results of the test. We are using, as Lynn mentioned, two techniques to measure flux at these four sites. The first one being the integral pumping test as developed by the researchers in Germany, and the other one, the PAS flux meters, as developed by the University of Florida. I'm going to first present results from the integral pumping test for the Hill site, and these slides here, these three graphs, then, are the TCE concentration time series information. The top graph is the concentration time series information from the pre-remedial flux measurement episode that was conducted in May of 2002. The following month, in June of 2002, they conducted a surfactant flood in the Dean Apple source area. Approximately a year later, in June of 2003, a first post-remedial flux measurement episode was completed, and then this past October of 2004, a second post-remedial flux measurement episode was complete. As you can see from these three slides here, one thing to note is that the concentrations are fairly consistent, and I'll come back to that point in a moment. But just to summarize the Darcy velocities based on the method that Ms. Lynn mentioned, for the three tests, we get the transect-wide average Darcy velocity based on the hydraulic information obtained during the integral pumping test of 2.9, 1.7, and 3.2 centimeters per day for the three different tests. And likewise, I'll come back to that point in a series of slides as well. So moving on to slide 55, one of the key steps that's needed in the integral pumping test is to use the concentration time series information to interpret the spatial concentration of the contaminant in capture zone of the well. If you have a fairly uniform concentration time series, however, as depicted in the graph in the lower right corner of slide 55, that implies a fairly uniform spatial concentration in the capture zone of the well, as depicted in the graphic on the lower left corner of slide 55. So what we did then is, given the uniform nature of the concentration time series that we measured in each of the wells for all three tests at the Hill site, we simply took the average of the concentration time series, and that then represents the average of the spatial concentration in the capture zone of our wells. That information then combined with and the transect-wide Darcy velocity gives us the well, gives us the flux for each well, which is shown on slide 56. This slide then summarizes the TCE flux for each well for the three tests. The blue squares are the pre-remedial flux measurement episode conducted in May of 02. The red triangles are the flux measurements from the first post-remedial flux measurements conducted in June of 03. And then the green circles are the second post-remedial flux measurements conducted in October of 04. My graphic says 03, but it is really October of 04. So you can see comparing the pre to the post measurements, we get roughly an order of magnitude decrease in the contaminant flux. And then comparing the first to the second post-remedial flux measurement episodes, we get some additional decreases in flux on the northern end of our transect and then some potential rebounding on the southern end of the transect, at least based on the interval pumping test data. So moving then to slide 57, this is a summary of the passive flux meter information as deployed and measured by the University of Florida. The top graphic represents results from the pre-remedial flux measurement episode, and the bottom graphic is results from the second post-remedial flux measurement episode. We don't have the information in this form to show for the June 03 results, so we'll just look at the pre-remedial to the last post-remedial measurement that were completed. So looking at the top slide, that is a two-dimensional depiction of the Darcy velocity. Each of those dots represents an individual passive flux meter sample that is a sample collected over a discrete 20-centimeter interval. That information was then used to generate the contours, the 2D contours that are shown there. So for the pre-remedial test, the Darcy velocities ranged from less than 1 centimeter per day over in well 154 to highs of approximately 10 centimeters per day in wells 148 and 151. The average of the Darcy velocity measurements was approximately 2.5 centimeters per day. For the post-remedial measurement that's conducted in October of 04, the water table is slightly higher, and in general, the Darcy velocities were less. The average was approximately 1.6 centimeters per day. The lows were generally less than 1 centimeter per day, when the high was only approximately 7 centimeters per day, in, as indicated by the dark blue in well 155. So then moving on to slide 58, this slide summarizes the flux measurements based on the passive flux meter information for the same two tests, the pre-remedial test in May of 02, and then the second post-remedial test in October of 04. The flux values, what's shown in these graphs are the log transform value of the flux, and that was done in an attempt to help accentuate the change or the reduction in flux. So starting with the pre-remedial measurements, in the top graphic, the flux ranged from approximately 0.5 grams per square meters per day over on wells 155 and 157 to highs of approximately 11 to 16 grams per square meter per day in wells 152, 116, and 149. The average was approximately around 2 grams per square meters per day. And then in the last post-remedial measurement, as shown in the lower graph, the fluxes were generally less than 0.1 grams per square meters per day, with hot spots of approximately 0.3 grams per square meters per day in wells 151 and 155. Now, I would note that dark region you see between wells 152 and 148, as well as that small dark blip in 116, that's again a graphic glitch. Those areas should all be white as nothing was detected in that range. So there was that the whole region should be white. So moving then on to slide 59, this is a comparison of the transect-wide average Darcy velocities between the two techniques. So I mentioned several slides back that based on the modified integral pumping test technique, we measured darcy velocities of 2.9, 1.7, and 3.2 centimeters per day for the May 02, June 03, and October 04 tests, respectively. Comparing those to the average of the passive flux meters, so these are the point measurements averaged over an entire transect to get a transect-wide average based on the passive flux meter information, we get 2.5, 1.5, and 1.6 centimeters per day for the three tests, respectively, as well. So then looking at the May 02 and the June 03 comparison, you can see that the two techniques give very comparable estimates of the darcy velocity. However, for the last test, the October 04 comparison, they differ by roughly a factor of two. And unfortunately, we had a lot of rain during October in 04, and we think that that rain interfered with our interpretation of the hydraulic information, and we suspect that's the main reason for the larger difference in the two techniques. The purple bar on the far left of the slide represents a range of darcy velocities based on modeling exercises that on-site environmental managers have conducted. So in general, all the flux values that we measured with the two techniques across the three tests have generally agreed with their independent modeling work. Moving on to slide 60, this slide compares the flux meter, the flux estimates between the two techniques. Plotted on the y-axis is the flux based on the passive flux meters, which is plotted as a function of the flux based on the integral pumping test. These are well-averaged flux values for both TCE and DCE for all three tests. And you see that in general, the comparison, the data follows a one-to-one relationship would suggest a favorable comparison between the two techniques. However, you will note that for the last test in particular, there's roughly as much as an order of magnitude difference in the flux based on the two techniques. Part of that deviation could be, again, due to our estimate of the darcy velocity and the interference from rainwater. But that's a factor of two, and it wouldn't certainly explain the deviation on order of magnitude. So moving on to slide 61, then I'm going to move on to the Fort Lewis site results from the work at the Fort Lewis site in Washington. This slide here shows a plan view of the Eastgate Disposal Yard on the Fort Lewis Army Base in Washington. And within that Eastgate Disposal Yard area, they've identified three distinct NAPL areas 1, 2, and 3. Our original CERTA project called for the measurement of pre- and post-remedial contaminant flux measurements immediately downgrading from Area 1. And that's what I'm going to focus on in the remainder of this presentation, but I would like to point out that there is actually a number of different activities ongoing which are using flux as a performance metric for specifically NAPL Areas 3 and the entire Eastgate Disposal Yard site as a whole. So moving to slide 62 then, this is a close-up view of NAPL Area 1, and the original CERTA project called for the measurement of pre- and post-remedial fluxes immediately downgrading from NAPL Area 1, and our Fluxwell transect is outlined in the by the green dashed line. It consists of 10 wells, which are spaced approximately 22 feet apart. To date, we've only conducted the pre-remedial flux measurements. They've completed in-situ resistive heating at the site, and we're currently waiting for the temperatures, groundwater temperatures, to come back to levels that are more representative of natural conditions. And the current plan is to go out this spring and conduct the post-remedial flux measurements. But I'm just going to show the pre-remedial flux measurements. And if you skip ahead to slide 63, I'll start off with the passive flux meter information. So this, then again, is a two-dimensional depiction of the darcy velocity distribution based on the discrete passive flux meter information. The velocities at this site were generally much higher than those at the hill site, and in making that comparison, you have to recognize that there's a unit change here. The average Darcy velocity based on the passive flux meter at the Fort Lewis site was around 1 centimeter per day, and it ranged from a low of about 0.3 centimeters per hour, the average was 1 centimeter per hour. It ranged from a low of about 0.3 centimeters per hour in the middle of transect to a high of about 2.8 centimeters per hour over on the left side of the graph at a transect distance of zero. Moving ahead to slide 64, this slide is again a two-dimensional depiction of the TCE flux estimates based on the passive flux meter information. And what's particularly interesting about this slide is it suggests that all the fluxes occur in a relatively localized area between, say, roughly 110 and 140 feet along the transect. The high flux in that region is approximately 0.07 milligrams per square meter per hour, and in the blue region it was generally less than 0.005 milligrams per square centimeter per hour. So that was the path flux meter information. In slide 65, this is a summary of the Darcy velocity information based on the modified interval pumping test. Now, this slide here represents results from a slightly different tact than what Lynn described. Based on the very high groundwater flow velocities and the small pumping rates that we employed during our interval pumping test technique, our first approach was to assume that we could neglect the interferences of one well on the other. So we treated the head information in each well independently and just basically analyzed the data in a step drawdown fashion. So using that information, we estimated a well-specific hydraulic conductivity, which then combined with a transect-wide average gradient gave us a well-specific Darcy velocity. And that's what's shown in this graph on slide 65. The Darcy velocities range from approximately 0.2 centimeters per hour in well 204 to a high of about 2 centimeters per hour in well 212. Also point out that the lines shown on the bottom and upper portions of that slide, those represent minimum and maximum estimates of Darcy velocity based on pre-remedial characterization work that was conducted at the site. So moving ahead to slide 66 then, The concentration time series information, similarly to the hill site, was fairly consistent, so that we again took the approach where the average of the concentration time series, we took that as a measure of the average spatial concentration in the capture zone of the well. That average then times our well-specific Darcy velocity estimates gives us a well-specific TCE flux estimate. So the blue triangles then represent the TCE flux estimate based on the interval pumping test results. As a means of comparison, I've also plotted the well average passive flux meter information, and you can see that there is some discrepancy, more so for the lower estimates of flux, say in well 201, but for the high estimates of flux in well 207 and 211, the two techniques give fairly comparable results. And it's also interesting to note that if you calculate the total mass that's crossing the transect as a function of time, those two estimates are fairly comparable between the two techniques because the high estimates in wells 207 and 211 are so close. So in slide 67, just to give a quick summary, specifically more for the field work, we're using two methods to measure flux. One, University of Florida is deploying and analyzing passive flux meters, and then the other is we're using a modified version of the IPT as developed by researchers in Germany, and we're attempting to use those methods to measure both pre- and post-remedial flux at four of the field sites. Today, we've only completed both pre- and post-remedial measurements at one of the sites, the Hill Air Force Base site, and we've seen roughly an order of magnitude decrease in the flux at that site. And finally, based on the flux estimates to date, we would say that there's the two methods give comparable results. And then finally, I'd just like to acknowledge on slide 68 that the valuable assistance we've gotten in conducting these tests at each of the four sites, as well as the funding source, which is CERTA for this work.
Thank you, Dr. Brooks. I'd like to thank both you and Dr. Wood for joining us today and offering your expertise on these issues. We'll move to the question and answer period in just one moment. I'd like to remind all of the Internet participants that you can submit a question using the question mark button at the top of the slides. Phone participants, you'll be able to take your phone off mute and ask a question of today's presenters.
I'll get us started on that.
Okay.
Slide 34, the schematic of the multi-level sampler showed a pretty tight spacing that I don't think was necessarily the scale, but Lynn or Michael, your Hill slide, you said you had 10 wells on 10-foot spacings, whereas Eastgate you had 10 at 22-foot spacings. Do you have any thoughts as to, and this actually then is eventually going to get to the issue of incremental cost over our traditional methods of point source concentration measurement. Are you thinking that to do mass flux types of measurements, we're going to be needing wells in the 10 to 22-foot range spacing? And if so, is that going to limit its applicability to smaller size plumes?
So I guess the first thought that would come to my mind is that would be the advantage of these methods that pump over a much larger volume. So potentially, if you have larger sites, you could use the IPT or Mark Goltz's technique and just try to pump larger to sample a larger volume.
I think the integrated pump test could, in fact, have a larger radius of influence. And is that something that we have the ability to determine at this point? Do you have algorithms that are going to enable you to determine the effective radius of influence, if I could use that analogy, to determine spacing for the IPT for larger plumes?
Certainly under ideal conditions. I mean, the caveat to that question is unknown heterogeneity certainly will come back to bite you all the time. But as a first cut, we typically have used homogeneous models, just simple pumping equations to try to get a feel for pumping times, pumping volumes, and try to get an idea of the sample space to get an idea of the space that we're actually sampling.
And then do you go back and validate those assumptions? I mean, do you, in terms of whether or not, because as you know, the norm is a heterogeneous case.
Yes.
And then, again, given the cost constraints of engineering practice, are we going to have the resources to go back and if it turns out that the homogeneous case, and I presume you build in a safety factor of some sort, it turns out that the fact the whales are not getting effective capture across the transect, have you had any cases or thoughts about having to go back and increase the density, if you will, of the spacing?
Well, a couple thoughts there. One being, you raise the issue of uncertainty, which is certainly forefront in all of our minds about how certain can we what's the level of certainty that we can place on these flux measurements? And I certainly don't have a easy answer for that. But towards the latter part of your question, I'd like to just point out that it is interesting that at the Port Lewis site, we adopted an adaptive strategy where we started off with placing wells along a control plane that had a fairly large well spacing. And the thought was that we'd do some preliminary work and assess the concentrations. And if we needed to, then yes, go back and install intermediate wells to try to adjust the issue that you just raised. So
one of the attributes of this approach is to have some flexibility in your budgeting to be able to adjust the conditions dictate. Just, I think where we're heading, not just for the characterization, but for remediation as well. One other quick question, and then we'll get to the phone lines and the Internet. When the tools were first developed in my discussions with Mike Annable, one of the issues that he thought was going to be significant from a practical engineering standpoint is this issue of re-equilibration time frames. Especially if you've got to wait a year, for example, before you could really be getting decent measurements as your system needs to re-equilibrate. You indicated that you thought that the passive flux meter was a minimum disturbance, and so the first question is there a, do you have an estimate of what the recalibration time frame would be for that tool? Again, I'm just looking here, are we talking months or years? And then you also suggested that you thought that your modified integrated pump test, I think you indicated, was less disturbing than the basic integrated pump test. And do you have any similar insights or suggestions as to what the re-equilibration time frames there might be?
I'll try to address that first, and I think Lynn had wanted to add something as well. But I think the one-year time frame that Mike Annable was referring to is actually the time you'd have to wait after remediation to measure fluxes at the downgraded control plane.
Well, actually, that was two parts to that. I appreciate you making that clarification. There is a re-equilibration is, in fact, a two-part phenomenon.
Yeah.
Re-equilibration after you've installed your system, and then, as I indicated in my initial remarks, and as you just have also appropriately indicated, there's also a potential perturbation of the hydrogeological regime as a function of the remediation. So, yes, Michael's Mike Annable's initial remarks were with regard to post-remediation re-equilibration, but is there a equilibration time frame even after the installation, especially for the IPT and the MIPT with their positive pumping?
I would think that they are similar in length of time, and it would not be an excessive. Certainly, it would be longer than the disturbance created by installation and retrieval of passive flux meters. But at least the way we've attempted to conduct the integral pumping test is we conduct it for a period of time, so we're just sampling space basically based on the well spacing. So, you could, again, as a first cut, deploy some simple analytical models to assess how much time you might need to use to wait if you needed to remeasure. But I'd say that certainly is a much smaller time frame than waiting for the larger site equilibrium to compare pre to post remedial measurements.
Yeah, again, the reason I'm bringing that up is not that anybody's going to rush out tomorrow and start trying to replicate your work, but the point is that the when we do get around to using this method, do people in fact need to build in some lead time to install the system before they can start generating reliable data? And that's what I was just looking for. Are we talking months? Would you recommend at the present time that it's best to get your systems in a couple of months before, for example, if you were trying to do a pre-remediation flux assessment? Is it 60 days, is that good enough? Or is that something, as you say, that you can try to model?
Well, I think to a large extent it's going to depend upon the hydrodynamics of the system,
right?
The flow you have. But I think in most cases we're talking about relatively short periods of time. Typically, if you can have wells installed, I think in maybe sites for a couple of weeks or a month in advance, you're likely to have re-equilibration and minimal disturbance as a result of the installation. But it's something obviously you need to be aware of and take in consideration and perhaps do some modeling. I think the bigger issue here, of course, with respect to equilibration is related to the remediation activity and not only the re-equilibration potentially of the hydrodynamics of the system, and of course you'll have the consideration of what particular remediation technology is implemented, and that will have an impact, but you may have to be concerned about re-equilibration of the geochemistry of the system as well as the contaminant concentration and equilibration within the system. And certainly, as Michael mentioned, at Fort Lewis, where they did a thermal remediation, we're allowing time for thermal re-equilibration for the temperatures to come back down to at least close to what the ambient conditions are so that we have what we think would be representative conditions, as well as allowing, hopefully at least two, three pore volumes of water to flow through the treated zone.
Larry, do you want to see if there's any phone or internet questions?
Sure. Phone participants, we'll check with you in just 1 minute. I've got one to read here from an internet participant. This is from Robert Glazier, Golder Associates, Incorporated in St. Charles, Missouri. He says, regarding slide 49, wouldn't it be possible to achieve the aqueous plume reduction shown in the bottom of the three drawings without any DINAPL source removal? For example, enhanced bioremediation might be designed to rapidly reduce the aqueous phase concentrations by designing the in situ biomass and nutrient delivery flux to match whatever the pre-remedial source zone DINAPL flux is. Did you get all that?
Yeah, I think certainly, I'm not trying to suggest here that it would have to be aggressive mass removal. This is just a depiction to show that what benefits that you might be able or you might expect or might see from mass reduction. And in fact, in the lower part of that slide, this is just a hypothetical representation of where you would perhaps have some reduction in mass flux as a result of reducing the mass that's in the source zone, as well as through an enhancement of the natural attenuation process. For instance, we've worked at a site at Sage's site at Jacksonville, Florida, which was a former dry cleaner site where a co-solvent flush using ethanol was applied to remove mass from the source zone, but that ethanol was also intended to be used to enhance or stimulate reductive dechlorination of the PCE at the site, and through monitoring over several years, we've been able to document that indeed that happened. So we have two process, complementary processes, coupling, if you want, sort of technologies, I think that Jim mentioned earlier at this site. So, yeah, there are hopefully many tools that we'll be able to use, and certainly to the extent that we can use the less aggressive, more passive, or less expensive techniques to meet our goals, that's preferable to the investment we have in these more aggressive methods.
Actually, there's another part to that question, though, and you flip it over, and that's where the regulators are going to be particularly interested and concerned in mass flux. Because, again, if all you've done is mask the remaining mass, the question of longevity of that source term, the time frames for which financial assurance, institutional controls might have to be made, the time frames for which pump and treat might have to be maintained. That's why I say, for me, there's two $64,000 questions. One is, can you reduce mass enough to reduce flux? But secondly is the time frame for restoration of the resource, and that's, as I say, an issue that I think the regulatory side of the house is going to be particularly interested in as they look at mass flux.
Right. It comes back to some of the same issues that you have to consider with respect to containment, of course, long-term stewardship and so forth.
Guys, let's just make a note here. We're going to run over a few minutes. I've got 4:01 right now. We can go on till about 4:15 or even a couple minutes after, as long as we have questions coming in. If any of our speakers need to leave, guys, we appreciate you sticking with us this long, and I'll talk to you soon. But let's continue on with the questions and check with our phone participants. If you've got a question for one of today's speakers, please take your phone off mute and introduce yourself and your organization and ask your question. Okay, I'm not sure if I've removed the lecture mode, so let's try one more time. Checking with the phone participants, if you've got a question, please take your phone off mute and introduce yourself and your organization and ask your question. Okay.
Actually, I have one more since I was prepared for this.
Please.
This just gets back to the discussion Luna and I had just a moment ago, and this gets into this issue of source strength, longevity, and predicting time frames for possible need to maintain containment remedies. about a year and a half ago when the Kavanaugh panel was doing its work, it became apparent that mass flux was not going to be the tool that would give us that ultimate information about longevity of the source and or restoration time frames or containment remedy maintenance time frames. Either Mark or Lynn, is there any thought that you've given to whether we could do something else in this domain that might elicit more insights with regard to the mass flux? I've seen one paper, for example, where someone took a multi-component PAH waste and by looking at the mass flux changes of different constituents over time, tried to draw some inferences about the remaining source strength, but I wasn't particularly persuaded by his work. But do you see any potential for mining the mass flux data in a way that might be more useful than otherwise would be the case?
I'll start, I guess, as a not certainly want to answer that in full, but just in part at least, the graphic that Mark Brousseau showed in slide 13, which is mass flux reduction versus mass removal. If we could develop tools where we could measure this type of a curve for specific sites, I think then that would help address the questions that you raised, Jim, about whether your remediation technique or the characteristics of the site suggest that by removing mass, are you going to decrease the source longevity or increase it? Because by removing mass, you've just reduced the flux to a greater extent and thereby increase the longevity of the source. So if we could develop tools to be able to measure these mass removal flux reduction responses, and they will have to be site-specific, I think that would help address the questions of source longevity.
Parker, Lynn?
I agree with that. I was going to make basically the same comment. And so I think to add on to that, to be able to determine one of these responses, response curves, or relationships, I think will entail a combination of work. So some of the mass flux measurement and monitoring activities that Lynn and Michael talked about, and combining that with other site characterization activities related to source zone, architecture, permeability distributions, and so on, and coupling in mathematical modeling built on our hopefully advanced understanding now of source zone dynamics and architecture effects, and put all that together so that we could take a few, however long, a year or months or so on, preliminary information at a field site, specific field site, and then employ our knowledge and modeling to hopefully then forecast this response and have a fairly good shot at reproducing what might actually occur at the site. And if we could do that, then we could hopefully start addressing what you're looking for.
That would be good, because again, one of my concerns with the site-specific response curve process, as Michael initially presented it, was that you wouldn't know till you were done. And what we need, again, is a forecasting tool where you can use it in advance to assist in your cost-benefit analysis of the degree to which active intervention is going to be your remedy of choice. Larry, any other email?
Yeah, let me just make a comment about that to follow up on and echo what Mark said, basically. It's really, I think, comes down to a matter of understanding the functional relationship here and the properties or the parameters that impact that or define that allow us to quantify that, and then to be able to either measure those in the field or, as Mark said, predict those based on properties that we can measure in the field. And to me, that's sort of the key, and I think where much of the current research is going.
Harry, any other email or...
Yeah, I've got a couple more things. Let me mention to everyone that if you have any additional questions that you don't get answered today, please feel free to contact me or the speakers from today's session and submit your questions just via email. I do have a question here from Jennifer Keeler at the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection in Norristown, and she asks if we're familiar with any methods that might be applicable to fractured bedrock settings.
A
cost implications are going to be significantly greater, obviously, of trying to put more wells in a fractured rock setting, especially deeper. But, Lynn, have you given any thought to that?
Very little. Trying to avoid it. Now, that's certainly a challenge, and I assume she's speaking in regard to measurement of mass flux in these systems. Obviously, some of the underlying assumptions that many of these use about the homogeneity, uniform flow, and so forth, can be a challenge there. And perhaps Michael's been giving it more thought than I have, but we of course, have been dealing with these forced media, unconsolidated type systems predominantly to this point in time.
I've got one more question here from Michael O'Hearn, MacTech ENC in Novi, Michigan. He notes that most of the current research seems to involve chlorinated solvents, such as TCE and PCE. What research is being done on less mobile DINAPLs, such as coal tars?
Jim, you may have...
Well, in a mass flux context, I take it because the session was about mass flux. One of the challenges there, of course, is that the coal tars and the creosotes, the PAHs, for example, tend to be somewhat less soluble, and or the... the other point is, I don't know that we're doing anything in that domain that's specific to this.
I think certainly these techniques can be applied to those type sites, and our focus is on the chlorinated solvents primarily because much of our support's currently is coming from DOD, and chlorinated solvents is a big issue for them. But again, with respect to the application of these flux measurement technologies, with respect to the differences in the type of contaminant, I don't see a particular big issue here.
Again, in principle, you should be able to do the same thing. I will say, though, on the general characterization front, one of the things we found by doing some work at a manufactured gas plant site in New York is that there are some problems with the fluorescence of the pHs, when especially in large concentrations. And so if one of your objectives is to determine source zones and distinguish free product or pooled apple from dissolve phase, that can be a challenge. You can actually get a suppression of the fluorescence response as the contamination mass increases. And there's been some recent tools, development efforts to develop a different laser excitation wavelength in the green range that does a better job of distinguishing between the free product NAPL and the dissolve phase.
Yeah, another consideration, obviously, is at many of these sites, coal tars and creosotes, the NAPL remains mobile for much longer periods of time, and you'd have to just be aware of that. Obviously, with the technologies we talked about, methods of measuring flux, you don't want to be in a NAPL zone to attempt to measure these.
That could be a challenge, is avoiding the NAPL zone. The other point, of course, is because of the NAPL's specific gravity, you can have a NAPL at a wood treater or an MGP site that you could have all three components. It could be an L-NAPL in some cases if the diesel or the petroleum hydrocarbon was a carrier, as was used with pentachlorophenol. You could have a neutrally buoyant free product mass, and or you could have it cooled on your aquitard. So you need to be particularly sensitive to the spatial distribution of your screened intervals.
Guys, I'd like to thank each of today's speakers, Dr. Brousseau from the University of Arizona and Dr. Wood and Brooks from Ada, Oklahoma, as well as Jim Cummings from Washington, D.C. Appreciate your participation today, and thank you so much for staying a little over to answer some of these questions. If any participants are still with us on the lines and you have a pending question, the remaining questions that I've received email, I will forward on to our speakers with your contact, and either they'll get back to me or get back straight to you. So we will get these additional questions answered. I'd like to thank everyone and just check with our speakers and see if anybody has any final comments today.
Just wanted to thank everyone for their attention.
And I would also like to thank the EPA and the Clue-In organization with the Technology Innovation Program for supporting us in the Superfund Basic Research Program and this initiative. So with that, I'll close off today, and just a final reminder that we will be having four additional sessions examining various DNAPLS issues, including remediation methods and monitoring and some other issues during the next couple of months. So stay tuned to TechDirect and the Clue-In calendar, and you'll see the additional sessions show up on the calendar there. And we invite you to join us and participate in any of those sessions as you can. With that, we'll close off, and I'd like to just thank everyone one last time, and we'll hope to see you in the next couple months on some of our additional seminars.
Thank you.